Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Joanne Lowney with the Wall Street Journal. Business news for Wednesday, July 30th, 2025. Our headlines today: Amazon to pay New York Times at least $20 million a year in AI deal. KKR pushes further into healthcare with deal for pharma royalty business. Adidas posts lower-than-expected sales as tariff burden lingers. How did a lone gunman breach one of New York's most secure skyscrapers? Starbucks abandons mobile order, pickup-only stores. Palo Alto Networks nears over $20 billion deal for cybersecurity firm CyberArk. ProSieben SAT.1 shares jump after MFE raises bid to $2.4 billion valuation. Waystar strikes deal for Iodine software. The first article I'll read today is Amazon to pay New York Times at least $20 million a year in AI deal. The multi-year deal lets Amazon use content from the Times News and Cooking sections and The Atlantic, by Alexandra Bruhl. Amazon's deal to license a broad range of New York Times content comes with a meaty payday from the publisher, $20 million to $25 million a year, according to people familiar with the matter. The financial terms of the multi-year deal, which haven't previously been disclosed, offer a window into how publishers and artificial intelligence companies are valuing news content in the midst of a seismic change in how consumers seek information online. The annual payment amounts to nearly 1% of the Times' total 2024 revenue. The companies announced their deal in May and said it gives Amazon access to content from the Times News and Cooking products. Amazon can use the material to train AI models and feature summaries and short excerpts of Times content in its products and services, including Alexa. It was the first AI-related licensing pact for the Times and Amazon's first such agreement with a publisher. The rising popularity of AI chatbots is upending traditional search traffic and associated ad revenue from publishers' website visits. Tech companies have used articles to train their AI models and pull from news sites to provide users with real-time answers to prompts about current events. OpenAI has agreements with several publishers, including a deal with Wall Street Journal parent News Corp. That deal, signed last year, could be worth more than $250 million over 5 years, the journal previously reported. OpenAI also has a 3-year pact with Business Insider and Politico owner Axel Springer, worth at least $25 million to $30 million. The structure of such deals varies widely, depending on the products and services the AI companies offer and how they wish to use the content. For example, to train their models, deliver chatbots answers quickly, or integrate news from emerging products, the Times deal consists of cash payments, according to people familiar with the matter. Other licensing deals may include different financial terms. The Times is currently suing OpenAI and Microsoft for copyright infringement. Two News Corp subsidiaries are suing AI-powered search engine Perplexity. The Amazon deal is consistent with our long-held principle that high-quality journalism is worth paying for, Times chief executive Meredith Kopit Levin said in a note to staff when the arrangement was announced in May. Write to Alexandra Bruhl at alexandra.bruell at wsj.com. KKR pushes further into healthcare with Deal from Pharma Royalty Business. HCRX has about $3 billion in assets under management, by Ben Glickman. KKR is set to acquire a majority stake in Healthcare Royalty Partners, according to people familiar with the matter, pushing the investment firm further into healthcare industry. Healthcare Royalty Partners, also known as HCRX, acquires the rights to royalty streams from pharmaceutical companies, either for drugs that are already generating sales or that those that are in later stages of development. HCRX has about $3 billion in assets under management. The deal is being done by KKR's management company, not one of its buyout funds, the people said. This means HCRX will become a part of KKR once the deal is complete. HCRX chief executive Clark Futch, a co-founder of the business, is expected to continue to hold a minority stake in the company, according to the people familiar with the matter. It's been a tough fundraising environment for biopharma startups, which rely on intermittent injections of new cash from investors to support clinical trials and bring drugs to market. Initial public offerings, a common way for smaller drug developers to raise cash from investors, have been relatively quiet for the sector this year. The SPDR S&P Biotech ETF is down about 4.5% this year, compared with a more than 8% gain in the S&P 500. The deal for KKR is a bet that financing needs from drug companies will continue to rise, prompting them to strike royalty deals. Among the biggest competitors in the drug royalty business are publicly traded Royalty Pharma, which has a market cap of about $20 billion, and Blackstone's Life Sciences Investment Unit. Write to Ben Glickman at ben.glickman@wsj.com. Adidas shares tumble after sales miss, guidance confirmation. Deutsche Bank had expected Adidas to upgrade its operating profit guidance, by Andrea Figueres. Adidas shares tumbled after the sporting goods company posted lower-than-expected sales and confirmed its outlook amid persistent uncertainty around the impact of U.S. tariffs. The German group said Wednesday that it continues to expect operating profit between 1.2 billion euros and 1.8 billion euros, which is 1.96 billion to $2.8 billion. In 2025, Adidas also targets an increase in currency-neutral sales at a high single-digit rate. The guidance is below consensus expectations of 2.085 billion euros in operating profit, according to a poll of estimates compiled by the company. Prior to results, analysts at Deutsche Bank had expected the company to upgrade its operating profit guidance. Shares went down 7.3% in European midday trading and have plunged 23% over the year to date. The year has started great for us, and normally we would now be very bullish in our outlook for the full year, chief executive Bjorn Gulden said. We feel the volatility and uncertainty in the world does not make this prudent. Since the CEO took the reins of Adidas in 2025, the group has lifted its targets on several occasions as part of its strategy to beat and increase expectations. Sales of 5.95 billion euros over the second quarter were 2.2% higher on year, but below analysts' views of 6.15 billion euros. Net profit jumped to 369 million euros from 190 million euros, while operating profit rose nearly 58% to 546 million euros. The update from Adidas comes just days after German rival Puma issued a profit warning, citing weaker-than-expected sales in core markets as well as tariff-related headwinds. Sporting goods companies have been bracing for the potential hit from President Trump's levies on imported goods to the U.S. When the Trump administration first unveiled plans to impose duties in April, the measures appeared particularly punitive for major footwear and apparel sourcing hubs, including Vietnam and Indonesia, among other Asian countries. In recent years, a number of companies, including apparel firms, turned to Vietnam as an alternative to China. Earlier this month, the U.S. and Vietnam reached a trade deal under which the U.S. will charge 20% tariffs on Vietnamese goods, instead of the 46% tariffs announced in April, before putting the duties on pause to allow for negotiations. While being less punitive than expected, the levies will still represent an increase in costs. As per the latest news, the group expects President Trump's tariffs to prompt an increase in costs for its products in the U.S. by up to 200 million euros during the rest of the year. The CEO said that the group has a solid and flexible supply base, allowing it to maneuver and adjust production in order to achieve the lowest cost and highest margins. The company is awaiting confirmation on the duties and said it would adjust prices once the final rates are known, but noted that any price hikes would only apply in the U.S. Write to Andrea Figueras at andrea.figueras@wsj.com. Global markets mixed as investors digest tariff impact on earnings. Share movers in European morning trade included Kering, Porsche, Adidas, and HSBC, by Dow Jones Newswire staff. U.S. stock futures were pretty much flat across the board after falls on Wall Street the prior session, as the S&P 500 ended its run of record highs. Investors have plenty to parse as they digest the impact of tariffs on corporate earnings and progress on trade deals. Ahead on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve and Bank of Canada are expected to hold rates. The advance estimate of second quarter GDP lands, as does the ADP private payroll data. There are earnings from Microsoft, Meta, and Qualcomm, among others, following a slew of corporate results in international markets. U.S. futures for the S&P 500 were flat early in Europe. Futures for the Dow Jones Industrial Average swapped between small gains. In Europe, the Stoxx Europe 600 dropped 0.3% in morning trading, with mixed picture across regional markets as Germany's DAX fell a touch, while there were small gains for France's CAC 40. France's GDP rose 0.3% on the quarter, faster than the 0.1% expansion forecast by analysts, and Italy's FTSE MIB, the UK's FTSE 100, lost 0.4%. Other stocks in Europe were mixed, as France's CAC 40 was flat and Germany's DAX fell 0.3%. Share movers in Europe included Kering, up 2.4%, and Porsche rose 2.8%. Adidas fell 7.6%, and in London, HSB fell 4.8%. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei 225 index ended flat. Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell 1.1%, and China's benchmark Shanghai Composite gained 0.2%. South Korea's Kospi ended up 0.7%. U.S. Treasury yields stabilized after falling Tuesday as investors anticipate the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates on hold but markets price in 2 rate cuts before year end. The 2-year Treasury yield was flat. The 10-year yield was also stable, while the 30-year Treasury yield fell 0.5%, basis point to 4.863%. The U.S. Treasury is expected to signal unchanged coupon auction sizes for at least several quarters in its quarterly funding announcement. The dollar fell after reaching a 1-month high Tuesday. The DXY dollar index against a basket of major currencies was down 0.1% to 98.829 after hitting a high of 99.141 on Tuesday. Oil prices held onto their largest gain in more than 5 weeks after President Trump threatened to impose tariffs on Russia in 10 days if Moscow doesn't reach a truce with Ukraine. Brent crude and WTI were up 0.6% to $72.10 and $69.64 a barrel, respectively, after settling over 2.5% higher in the previous session. Write to Barcelona Editors at barcelonaeditors@dowjones.com. How did a lone gunman breach one of New York's most secure skyscrapers? Shooting at Midtown Manhattan Tower exposes how eliminating threats can be nearly impossible, even in fortified workplaces. By Chip Cutter. The Park Avenue building where a gunman killed 4 people on Monday is fortified more heavily than most. Concrete planters line the sidewalk. Security guards stand watch in the lobby. Video cameras monitor movements. Access procedures require visitors to register in advance, enter through a limited number of doors, and pass security gates to reach elevators. So how did a lone shooter penetrate all of that? The deadly rush hour shooting at the Midtown Manhattan skyscraper is spurring a furious review of security procedures inside large U.S. employers, building security experts say. The attack demonstrated that even a well-guarded workplace is vulnerable to someone striding in with a high-powered M14 rifle intent on doing harm. The gunman, a 27-year-old Shante Tamura of Las Vegas, walked into the lobby openly holding the rifle, shooting first an NYPD officer working an off-duty security shift, then an unarmed security guard, and a Blackstone executive, police said. Tamura appeared to have shot at one of the roughly waist-high glass turnstiles, an employee of private equity firm Blackstone said, before making his way into an elevator and shooting another person on the 33rd floor. If you're encountering a threat actor, an assailant who is willing to trade his life for yours, it's extremely difficult to defend, said Tim Gallagher, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation special agent and now co-head of physical security and threat mitigation at the investigations firm Nardello. In many ways, 345 Park Avenue appeared to do everything right from a security standpoint, Gallagher said. The building where the National Football League, Blackstone, accounting firm KPMG, and real estate management firm Rudin Management have offices, had an off-duty New York City Police Department officer stationed in the lobby. It used an advanced automated video surveillance system. At least one or two security guards manned a front desk to access a series of elevator banks reaching upper floors. Workers had to scan a badge at turnstiles that opened modern glass gates. Such a multi-layered security program is widely seen as best practice, said Gallagher, who has visited the address multiple times and advised companies that work in the building. Security is tight, he said. New York's Governor Kathy Hochul, speaking to CNN, cited the presence of the off-duty police officer as a sign of the building's robust security. I don't know how you get more secure than that, she said. What has rattled professionals across the U.S. is the sense that such a shooting could easily happen in their own offices. Brian Steffens of TENEO, who works with companies across the industries on security matters, said he heard from many clients in the hours after the shooting, including multinationals and real estate owners. The simple question is there anything we need to think about differently based on what happened, said Stevens, a former chief security officer at Bank of America. The answer, he said, is complicated. Securing corporate offices in a dense urban setting, such as Manhattan, can be particularly difficult. Unlike suburban office parks or other corporate facilities, where individuals might be stopped at a guard station far from a building, companies in a city can do only so much to restrict guests coming and going from the lobby. Many companies already monitor for threats online, conduct annual safety training with workers, and encourage colleagues to speak up if they see something suspicious. But once a suspect takes down lobby security staff, as happened on Monday, it becomes easier to access the office floors. Some companies are beginning to install artificial intelligence-enhanced video surveillance software to look for anyone who appears to have a weapon. Such systems can then immediately trigger a building to go into lockdown mode, or for staffers to disable elevator service, Stevens said. The idea is that even if he does get inside, he's not going anywhere within the tower, Stevens said. Such technology can be expensive and is still evolving, though. I certainly wouldn't call it commonplace, he said. Security experts say employees themselves play a critical role in thwarting a workplace attack. Monday's shooting showed just how practiced younger workers are in taking quick action. After growing up with the active shooter drills as a regular part of school life, witnesses and security experts said, many staffers went immediately into run-hide-flight mode when the shooting started. Attempting to barricade doors or hide can be helpful in deterring a shooter in situations where seconds matter, security specialists said. New York City Mayor Eric Adams, in an interview with Fox News on Tuesday, said the building's owner, the Rudin family, had created safe rooms that doubled as bathrooms with bulletproof doors within the building and conducted several active shooter drills. Such measures likely saved lives, Adams said. Dale Buchner, chief executive of Global Guardian, a security firm that has clients in the building, said he had visited 345 Park Avenue numerous times and had seen the glass turnstiles in the lobby in action. It's unclear whether the government gunman broke the turnstiles or accessed the elevators by jumping over them. How he got through, though, is almost irrelevant, he said. The key takeaway being, we simply need to make it more difficult, and there's got to be a way to shut down that lobby to minimize his mobility, if you will. Then these things happen. One additional solution, he said, is for the lobby guards to be seated behind bulletproof glass, akin to a model in heavily fortified U.S. embassies overseas, and to have additional layers of security to more easily isolate a shooter. That might sound a little too over the top or draconian, he said. I think that inevitably this is where we're going to end up. Write to Chip Cutter at chip.cutter@wsj.com. Starbucks abandons mobile order pickup only stores. CEO Brian Nichol says grab-and-go coffee houses are overly transactional. By Owen Tucker Smith and Heather Hayden. Starbucks is moving away from operating stores that only accept mobile orders or pickup because they don't have the right vibes. Executives from the world's largest coffee chain said Tuesday that the changes are part of a broader reshaping of its portfolio of U.S. stores. The company operates around 80 to 90 locations, some of which are in office buildings that don't offer seating and are designed to get customers out quickly. some locations could be converted to locations with seats. We found this format to be overly transactional and lacking the warmth and human connection that defines our brand, Chief Executive Brian Nichol told investors on a Tuesday earnings call. This chain has started work on a prototype, Coffee Houses of the Future, with 32 seats and a drive-through that it expects to open in its next fiscal year, he said. Since Nichol became CEO last year, he has pushed for Starbucks to offer more welcoming environments and invest in stores and worker training to boost service. Chief Financial Officer Kathy Smith told investors that Starbucks is investing more than $500 million to increase staffing in its U.S. company-operated stores in the next year. The changes are part of the company's response to months-long sales slump. On Tuesday, the company said same-store sales declined for the sixth consecutive quarter and that a decline in orders offset higher average ticket prices. Business conditions aren't getting any easier, Smith cautioned investors of an uncertain consumer environment ahead and said that the company was taking a conservative position on its results for the current quarter. Both the tariff environment and coffee prices are dynamic, Smith said, adding that executives were confident the company's finances would improve in 2026. Competition is growing for Starbucks in the U.S. and its key China market, with rivals pitching faster service and cheaper drinks. Nichol said the turnaround underway at Starbucks is ahead of schedule. Stores involved in a pilot program meant to improve the customer service experience have reported an improvement in service times and sales, Nichol said. The company is also testing new technology to try to speed up and better schedule orders, as well as introducing on-trend menu options like poached protein-infused cold foam beverages. While our financial results don't yet reflect all the progress we've made, the signs are clear. We're gaining momentum, Nichol said. Starbucks shares rose around 3% in after-hours trading. For its third quarter ended June 29th, Starbucks reported adjusted earnings of 50 cents a share, sharply lower than what analysts polled by FactSet expected. Earnings were pressured by company investments in its staff as well as June internal leadership summit. Investors are closely watching how much the turnaround will cost, particularly when it comes to additional investments in labor. Nichol is also pushing to cut expenses, including offering buyouts to corporate workers and stock grants to executives who meet cost-cutting and operational goals. Write to Owen Tucker Smith at owen.tucker-smith@wsj.com and Heather Hayden at heather.hayden, that's H-A-D-D-O-N, at wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Procter & Gamble says consumers are under stress. The company behind brands like Tide, Charmin, and Pantene says it is seeing signs of slower spending across its product categories. By Nakasha Khan. Procter & Gamble, long bellwether for the health of the U.S. consumer economy, says American shoppers are slowing down. Consumers are using up their pantry inventory, delaying purchases and shopping at stores less frequently to avoid the temptation to buy things they don't immediately need, said P&G's chief finance officer, Andre Schulten. The company reported quarterly earnings on Tuesday. The maker of Tide detergent, Charmin toilet paper, and Pantene shampoo has seen signs of slower spending across its product categories in recent weeks, he said. We really see that the consumer is under some level of stress, said Shulton. P&G's fourth quarter net sales rose 2% to $20.9 billion, slightly above the expectations of analysts polled by FactSet. Its net earnings per share also exceeded expectations, climbing 17% to $1.48, in large part because of a big restructuring change. P&G said it expects fiscal year 2026 sales growth of between 1% and 5% from the previous year, and for net earnings per share to climb 3% to 9%. It reiterated that tariffs could add $1 billion to its annual costs. Shulton said consumers of different income groups are feeling the squeeze. Lower-income consumers are actively looking for price promotions and smaller pack sizes to manage their costs from paycheck to paycheck, while high-income consumers are scouring for deals too. Both consumer segments are looking for value, but looking for value with their respective constraints, said Shulton, who added that the company is observing the slowing demand in both the U.S. and Western Europe. On Monday, P&G announced that Chief Executive John Mohler would step aside and become Executive Chairman in January. Mohler, who took the job in 2021, is being succeeded by Chief Operating Officer Shailesh Jalchakar, who joined the company in 1989. The company faces more challenges now than any time I can remember, said Mueller, who has been with the company for 38 years. The good news is we also have more opportunities here than at any time I remember. Write to Natasha Khan at natasha.khan@wsj.com. UnitedHealth continues to struggle as rising medical costs shortfalls affect business. Company says it had failed to predict or account for the increase in costs when it set its pricing for 2025, particularly in its Medicare business. By Anna Wild Matthews and Danny Jacob. UnitedHealth Group said its earnings will plunge this year to a level below even Wall Street's lowered expectations, highlighting rising costs and operational shortfalls across its business. Chief Executive Stephen Hemsley, who retook the job in May after an interim as chairman, sought to offer a reset after a financial meltdown that has pushed down the company's valuation by hundreds of billions of dollars this year. Hemsley said it chastened tone in a long call with analysts on Tuesday as he and other executives highlighted a series of missteps and planned strategy changes, including pullbacks in areas that the healthcare company has long positioned as growth engines. As we continue to assess the state of our business, it's very apparent that some require a fundamental reorientation, others require building and nurturing, and others must be reconsidered and redirected to original purpose, Helmsley said. He said the company will return to moderate earnings growth in 2026 with strengthened performance in 2027 and after. UnitedHealth now expects adjusted earnings of at least $16 per share in 2025, well below FactSet's consensus projection of $20.64 per share. Before its woes emerged, UnitedHealth in January had said it would deliver adjusted earnings of $29.50 to $30 per share. UnitedHealth said rapidly rising medical costs hit all of its insurance businesses. The company said it had failed to predict or account for that increase when it set its pricing for 2025, particularly its Medicare business, but said its designs for 2026 assume a continued acceleration in medical expenses. The results offered little obvious reassurance to investors spooked by a series of financial blow-ups by health insurers, which were struggling with rising costs and regulatory changes across various lines of business that have made medical spending trends harder to forecast. UnitedHealth shares were down about 5% in midday trading as investors digested Helmsley's new financial baseline. The company's value has fallen more than 40% this year, following a first-quarter earnings shortfall and its withdrawal of financial guidance in May. For the second quarter of 2025, UnitedHealth reported adjusted earnings per share of $4.08 compared with $6.80 a year earlier, an analyst projection of $4.48. Net income in the second quarter was $3.41 billion, down from $2.22 billion a year ago, and revenue totaled $111.6 billion. The medical loss ratio, or the share of premiums spent on healthcare costs, was 89.4%, higher than analysts expected, which was 89.2%. The company has long been seen as a bellwether in the industry, as the parent of the largest health insurer, UnitedHealthcare, and a health services arm, Optum, that includes doctor groups, a pharmacy benefit manager, and health data assets. It has commanded a premium over rivals from investors, an advantage that has faded this year. UnitedHealth flagged problems in healthcare across in UnitedHealthcare across Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance, including an Affordable Care Act plans known as Obamacare. The company said healthcare costs are now running $6.5 billion higher than expected for 2025. In Medicare, the company is now targeting a lower margin than it historically did, and it will exit plans that currently include around 600,000 enrollees. In the ACA business, it said it may pull out of some markets and expects membership to drop as federal subsidies that help enrollees shrink next year. The company also highlighted problems in its healthcare unit, Optum Health, which has been presented to investors as a key driver of aggressive growth in profits. UnitedHealth said changes to how the federal government sets a payment based on Medicare plan enrollees health will cost Optum Health about $11 billion total over 3 years, more than it previously expected, and that it mishandled efforts to offset that impact. Optum Health is pulling back on some of its efforts to manage the financial risk of patients, saying that it is losing money on many of those it added under such arrangements in 2024 and 2025. The company said long-term margins for Optum Health should be 6% to 8%. UnitedHealth also referred to an aspect of its financial performance that has long been opaque, the role of its deal-making. The company flagged about $3.65 billion in its financial outlook downgrade tied to decisions to pause or discontinue previously planned portfolio actions. Even as Helmsley is seeking to establish more clarity around its future, UnitedHealth and the rest of the industry are facing upheaval that is likely to intensify in the future, as rising healthcare costs coincide with changes sparked by government actions. Last week, UnitedHealthcare confirmed it was under civil and criminal investigation by the Justice Department. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this year on the probes, both of which involved the company's Medicare billing practices. The Medicare agency and some members of Congress have signaled plans to re-examine how private Medicare plans get paid based on the medical conditions of enrollees, a setup examined in a series of journal articles last year. The ACA business is likely to see spiking rates next year, and the recently passed Republican tax and spending package includes major changes to Medicaid that are expected to shrink the program's roles. Most Medicaid enrollees get their benefits through private insurers. Write to Anna Wild Matthews at anna.matthews@wsj.com and Denny Jacob at denny.jacob@wsj.com. UPS shares decline as lack of guidance, weaker results show prolonged challenges. Revenue fell 2.7% to $21.22 billion as the company delivered fewer packages, by Rob Current and Danny Jacob. United Parcel Services' financial results fell from a year earlier as the iconic brown delivery fleet dropped fewer packages to Americans' doorsteps and warned that economic visibility was still too poor to provide guidance. The package giant said, "While the U.S. economy has demonstrated continued resilience, the U.S. small package market was being weighed down by consumer sentiment, which is near historic lows. This prompted the company to continue withholding any revenue or earnings guidance for the year. For our sector, this remains a very unsettling time," Chief Executive Carol Tome said on an earnings call. "Changes in trade policy have been cemented, and the impact on consumer demand and overall economy is unknown." Outside the U.S., the company's trade route to China, its most profitable, saw average daily volume decline nearly 35% in the quarter amid an environment of higher tariffs and the elimination of the de minimis exemption. Other points of pressure include higher than anticipated delivery expenses for UPS, ground server offering and volume declines from the company's decision to reduce its work for Amazon.com. Shares declined 9.7% to $91.69 on pace for its lowest close since May 15, 2020. The stock is among the worst performers in the S&P 500 Tuesday. The Atlanta company recorded second quarter earnings of $1.28 billion or $1.51 a share, down from $1.41 billion or $1.65 a share a year earlier. Stripping out certain one-time items, earnings came in at about $1.55 a share. Analysts polled by FactSet had expected a $1.56 a share in adjusted earnings. Revenue fell 2.7% to $21.22 billion. Analysts polled by FactSet had expected a $20.85 billion. Domestic revenue fell 0.8% to $14.808 billion, reflecting lower volumes. Average daily domestic package volume slid 7.3% to 16.6 million. UPS earlier this month offered buyouts to delivery drivers for the first time in its 117-year history amid stagnant parcel volumes, rising labor costs, and a long slump in its share price. Write to Rob Curran at rob.curran@wsj.com and Denny Jacob at denny.jacob@wsj.com. Novo Nordisk's new obesity drug beats Wegovy weight loss in early trial. The drug maker is racing to develop the next generation of obesity medicines, by Dominic Chopping. Novo Nordisk's new weight loss drug helped patients lose even more weight on average than its current Wegovy blockbuster treatment, an early-stage trial showed, as the drug maker races to develop the next generation of obesity medicines. The company's drug, known as Amersetin, helped patients lose over 24% of their weight, which compares with an average of about 17% for its Wegovy treatment. The drug mimics the same gut hormone as the Wegovy treatment to suppress appetite, delay stomach emptying, and control blood sugar, but combines it with amylin, a hormone in the pancreas that also regulates appetite. The new treatment was administered as a once-weekly shot and a daily pill, with results showing that side effects were mostly in line with other obesity medicines. Patients taking the amycretin injection lost an average of 24.3% of their weight when dosing up to a 60 milligram shot over 36 weeks of treatment, while those on the pill lost up to 13.1% over 12 weeks. Data published earlier this week showed amycretin achieved a 22% weight loss in patients on a 20 milligram dose over 36 weeks. The data was published in The Lancet and presented at the American Diabetes Association conference over the weekend. Novo Nordisk plans a late-stage trial for the new drug early next year. The Danish drug maker is trying to develop a new obesity medicines as competition from Eli Lilly's Zepbound is, as well as copycat versions of its drugs, have dented sales in the key U.S. market. Some disappointing results in recent trials and concerns over lower pricing in the U.S. have also hit sentiment, and the company's last month ousted its chief executive. Over the weekend, Novo Nordisk said, separately, that full results from the study into its next-generation obesity shot, CagriSema, showed that its safety profile is comparable with drugs such as Wegovy. It said a low number of patients dropped out of the trial due to adverse events, which were mainly gastrointestinal, transient, and mild to moderate in severity. These results reinforce our confidence in CagriSema, and we continue to study the potential of its combination, Martin Holst Lang, Executive Vice President and Head of Development at Novo Nordisk, said. CagriSema combines the main ingredient in Wegovy with cagrilatide, an experimental drug that mimics amylin. Early study data of the drug late last year disappointed investors with the weight loss it achieved, wiping out nearly $100 billion of the drug maker's stock market value. The trial showed overweight or obese volunteers without type 2 diabetes lost an average of 22.7% of their weight after 68 weeks, falling short of the 25% Novo Nordisk had expected. In further data presented at the conference, the company said patients with obesity but without diabetes achieved mean weight loss of 21% when taking a higher dose of Wegovy than is currently marketed. A third of patients lost 25% of their weight, it added. The trial tested a 7.2 milligram dose of the drug and found the safety and tolerability was consistent with the currently approved 2.4 milligram dose, it said. Novo Nordisk expects to file the higher dose of Wegovy for a label update in the EU in the second half of 2025, followed by regulatory submissions in other markets where Wegovy is already approved. Write to Dominic Chopping at dominic.chopping@wsj.com. And now for some opinion articles. Trump blunders his fight with Harvard. U.S. universities need lasting reform, but are likely likely to think they can weather the current system. By Mark Halpin. Picturing a Frenchman in a beret, John Bull in a derby, and Uncle Sam in a top hat, one might think of once great, always arrogant Harvard as someone sitting on a stool in the corner, blank of eye, in a dunce cap with a big H on it. But in the other corner, in a dunce cap with a big M on it, is MAGA. Certainly, much of the academy has disposed of the ability to reason. Consider its embrace of the term settler colonialism as a kind of ideological duct tape with which kafaya-clad youth in attempt to address the complex questions such as, what river, far beyond their ken, first apprenticed to beating the dead horse of defunct European empires, they now deploy settler colonialism against the existence of not only Israel, but the U.S. According to Oxford, which should know, A colony is a body of settlers politically connected with their parent state, as long as the connection lasts. Israeli settlers on the West Bank might fit the bill if the disputed territory hadn't been part of Israel for thousands of years. As for the whole of Israel, the countries of Europe that slaughtered 2/3 of their Jews aren't its mother countries, certainly not Germany or the British Empire, against which the Jews prosecuted an anti-colonial war to create their modern state. Are the mother countries of the nearby 1 million Sephardic Jews who left or were expelled from them Egypt, Morocco, Yemen, Iran, et al.? If Israel is a settler colony, then it is therefore, and preposterously, a colony of, inter alia, Iraq. The mother country of Israel, however, is Israel. When Rome colonized Israel and Judea, it named them Palestine after the Philistines, European colonists on the coast of what is now Israel. Throughout history, waves of imperial conquest, Assyrians, Egyptians, Babylonians, Romans, Arabs, Crusaders, Ottomans, Englishmen, have washed over the land of Israel, where the Jews have always lived and insist upon staying. If the Jews who fled Arab lands and can't return are settler colonists in Israel, then the Arabs who fled Israel and can't return are, by the same insane logic, also settler colonists, such as in Gaza, and therefore analogous colony of Israel, which presumably directed its colony to attack it on October 7th. Although the Academy ignores, to various degrees, China's colonization of Tibet and Xinjiang, Russia's war of contrast and Russification in Ukraine, and Islamism's drive for universal Sharia, it apologizes to Native Americans, or rather, as anyone born in America is a Native American, to the original inhabitants. They are not, in fact, Aboriginal, as they are the result of many conquests and displacements of whoever was there first. And like Israelis without a mother country, they can't be settler colonists, as given the events of 1776, neither can Americans. If the change is that, unlike, as in the Oxford definition, settler colonialism persists after the connection is severed, then, as the earth was populated not always politely, virtually no country is exempt, and certainly not Arab claims on Palestine after the Islamic conquest of the Levant. The university left believes, rightly, that by tradition, legal precedent, and constitutional command, a child born in the U.S. is an American. But generous and just, we speak of our native land. This applies to the newborns or of even illegal immigrants. Why then would some hold that, for example, a 15th-generation American-born descendant of John Winthrop would be guilty of settler colonialism? Conforming to this logic, a 4th-generation Arab-Palestinian born in France has the right to stay in France, but a 4th-generation Israeli descendant of Iraqi Jews must, according to the yet-to-be-amended Palestine National Covenant, pack his bags for Baghdad. It isn't surprising that in service of bitter opposition to Israel and America, the Academy mobilized the bankrupt and inapplicable nostrum of settler colonialism. Following the delusions of bitter, crazy French and German academics, whole generations have been taught that sex is mutable, reality is self-defined. One must be a racist to be an anti-racist. Freedom of speech is oppression, and police cause crime, and the world will end in 2018, which they should be told it didn't. As the universities reached a crescendo of disorder in opposition to fundamental American principles, the Trump administration waded in, but not with capable adults, not the lockstep minions of President Trump, who himself behaves like a wild boar crashing through a field of well-tended crops. Look carefully at the eyes, and you see it. His chief resort is to thoughtless and impulsive action saved, if it is, by the momentum of lurching into the next thing. Hence, the if not unconstitutional, then overbearing, demands upon Harvard such as acquiescence to government direction in hiring and curriculum, and the threats to ban foreign students wholesale and end funding for virtuous research totally unconnected to any misconduct, thus alienating and perhaps crucial number of those who might otherwise press for reform. The administration has bore-handedly, or perhaps cleverly, extended commendable initiative against collegiate anti-Semitism into the pretext for pursuing its more valued objective of altering the university's political leanings. Misaligned pretexts weaken legitimate argument, and this one will divert inevitable anger and resentment onto you know who. An ill-considered attack will often strengthen its target. As a matter of principle, to defend their principles, faulty and otherwise, the universities will weather financial sanctions rather than ephemeral pressure fueled by revenge, winning and harvesting cash, all of which could be engraved on the Trump family crest. Effective change that doesn't beg for a reversal must come from pressure supported by careful and patient initiatives that pass constitutional scrutiny, where the university have violated the law, bringing suit against their trustees and administrators so as to establish firm precedent and persuade public opinion would be far more effective than wielding the executive power of government to make will-o'-the-wisp deals. As in so many other areas, the administration's object is to provoke everything and everybody while keeping an increased number of plates in the air. Seldom has such a strategy ended in anything but collapse. Though the university's cry out for the correction as MAGA carelessly overplays its hand, their madness, sensing an echo, will seek and find 1,000 channels of escape. Mr. Halpern's next novel will be Elegy in Blue by Abrams Press, 2026. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sunsounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sunsounds.